Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The Museum of the Bible opens today in Washington, D.C., right in the shadow of the Capitol, almost on the Mall, two blocks from the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum. It's an impressive exhibit with plenty of controversy. A $500 million monument to the Bible built by the Green family, the billionaire evangelical Christian family that owns the Hobby Lobby chain of arts and crafts stores, the one that successfully sued the government over requiring contraception coverage, the one that was busted in July for illegally smuggling biblical artifacts into this country for trading in the black market for antiquities. This hour on Point, the Museum of the Bible and the Hobby Lobby family story. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are you headed for the Museum of the Bible? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us first today from Washington is Philip Kennicott, Pulitzer Prize-winning art and architecture critic for The Washington Post. He's visited the Museum of the Bible three times already. His piece in The Post this week headlined, "The New Bible Museum Tells a Clear, Powerful Story, and It Could Change the Museum Business." You can link to that at our website, onpointradio.org. Philip Kennicott, welcome. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What is the, I mean, let's just start with this as an edifice and as a museum. Is it big? Is it small? Is it medium? Is it imposing? Is it impressive?
Well, in terms of the building and the exhibitions that people encounter, it is quite impressive. It's done at a design level very professionally. It's a $500 million project. It's a building spread out over eight floors. It's beautifully done on the interior. And if you want to spend time there, you could spend probably days before you made it through all of the content that's on offer.
It could sound like, oh boy, we're going to go in and study ancient texts. Is this jazzy or is this academic?
Well, it's a mix of jazz and fairly serious factual explanation or an attempt at factual explanation. It's a very tech-heavy museum, like a lot of museums that have opened recently. It's got interactive screens. It's got video. It has sound. A lot of little video theaters, quite professionally done films in these theaters. They are trying to fuse entertainment and education at a very complex way. And they succeed in many ways more than a lot of other museums do, because they don't put the cart before the horse. When they use this technology to tell their story, they're very intent on the story itself. This isn't about just sort of pressing buttons or watching screens. It's about getting their message across.
You say it could change the museum business. How? What do you mean?
Well, because the museum offers ultimately what I call, you know, a grand narrative of the Bible, it is quite different in feel from other new museums, where the effort really is about sort of presenting a multiplicity of viewpoints. This is not a museum that puts in the foreground multicultural issues. It wants to tell a linear chronological narrative. And I think there are a lot of people who come to town looking for a kind of simple, easy to understand and easy to share with their family sense of American history. And it does that. So it arrives as a technologically sophisticated museum, but a rather old-fashioned one in a way that I think fairly conservative audiences may appreciate when they come to town.
And it's not just the Bible's story. It's woven through with the American story in this presentation.
They are inextricable. The Bible, if there's a message of this museum, it is that the Bible is fundamental to America, that it is the most influential book in the world, and that you really can't conceive of American cultural life without the Bible.
Is it a religion-promoting museum? That may sound funny because it's promoting the interest in the Bible, which is the fundamental Christian text and more than that. But is it a religious museum?
That's an important and a complicated question. It is not an overtly proselytizing museum. This is not a theme park about creationism. It is fairly even-handed when it deals with the sort of material history of the Bible. And it, in many cases, will be fairly open about acknowledging what the curators deem the misuse of the Bible. For instance, the use of the Bible to support slavery in American history. But as you look at the exhibitions and as you look at the kind of emotional thread that's put together across all of the floors in this museum, you realize that this is fundamentally a biblical museum. This is about the grand narrative of the Bible and the American experience of the Bible. And if there's a theme music that comes out here, it really is Onward Christian Soldiers, even if they don't explicitly say so.
What's the perhaps that's the narrative, but how would you describe the narrative? What is the story or the way the Bible's presented here? If there's a grand narrative, what's the story?
Well, there are certain assumptions that are built into every exhibition here. Foremost, that the Bible is an important book, that it's the most influential book, but also that the Bible has been transmitted with a great deal of consistency and accuracy. So when they use archaeological or historical evidence, it's almost always to show the consistency of the Bible, as if there is a kind of inevitability to the way in which the Bible emerges out of ancient cultures, gets transmitted through the Dark Ages and the Renaissance and comes down to America really in the form of the King James Bible as a kind of inerrant book.
We'll get a little bit here from the president of the Museum of the Bible, Kerry Summers, talking with NBC News yesterday on a tour of the museum opening today.
Museum President Kerry Summers mixes the traditional and the trendy. From 13 fragments of the Dead Sea Scrolls, the oldest copies of biblical texts, to Elvis's Bible.
He underlines some texts and makes notes.
To a recreation of the Nazareth Jesus walked.
Could we make the Bible really cool? And so that's what we're about.
Could we make the Bible cool? The head of the new Museum of the Bible. Are there nods here to separation of church and state in this Museum of the Bible right in the middle of Washington, D.C., to the diversity of religious backgrounds of American citizens, Philip?
There are nods, absolutely. This is not a book that wants to leave a museum that wants to leave everybody else out that is not evangelical Christian. There are nods to the fact that the Christian tradition in the United States is multivalent and diverse. Catholicism, baptism, it acknowledges those things. It tends to do so in a way that lets you make up your own mind when the question is not particularly threatening to the biblical worldview, but also ignores issues or very carefully glides over them when it gets into areas where there is more controversy, there is more concern.
I've got a little bit of video here from – this is Steve Green and a couple of others. He was from the Hobby Lobby family and a couple of other employees talking about the location of the museum, why it's important that it be right in the middle of the action in Washington.
So Washington, D.C. is a great location for us to be able to share this story with people all over the world.
Putting ourselves in the middle of that holds us to quite a high standard and says that we're willing to engage on that level.
To have the Museum of the Bible there as a part of that overall culture adds to the commentary of who we are.
Philip Kennicott is with the Washington Post, and this is very close to the mall. It's very close to sort of the federal museums that are so famous in American cultural life. What about the placement of this and what it suggests, what that in itself says, Philip?
Well, from a marketing point of view, which the Greens are exceptionally good at, this is a brilliant placement at the museum. It's in a part of town, southwest Washington, that is very close to the mall but has been mainly ignored by people who are looking to put tourist hubs in. Mm-hmm. It's just off the center. It's right above a metro line, so it's easy to get to. And I think in some ways that becomes a metaphor for how they conceive of their relationship to larger Washington. They want the museum to bear up when it comes to scrutiny with other museums like the Smithsonian Museums that are only a few blocks away. But they also want to be very much apart from the mainstream culture of Washington. So at the professional level, they look very, very similar. But when you dig in at the philosophical level, you see fundamental differences. And as an example, I would say that in some ways this does for museums what Fox News may have done for news. It creates a sort of separate realm, a separate place where it all looks sort of the same if you just flip back and forth. But as you dig into it and you listen to it, you realize that the assumptions underlying it are fundamentally different.
And the controversy over how antiquities were acquired that were originally intended for this museum. The Hobby Lobby family there, does that show up? Is it addressed? Is it talked about?
Well, there was a case in which Hobby Lobby had to pay a $3 million federal fine for illegally smuggling antiquities. And this is a severe dent in the reputation of the museum. The museum would like to say, that was Hobby Lobby, we're the museum. But of course, it's all the same people involved, and it's not easy to make that distinction. They do a relatively good job of addressing issues of authenticity. For instance, are the Dead Sea Scrolls that are on view authentic? And there's considerable doubt that they are, and so they acknowledge that. They do a far less transparent job of acknowledging that case in which these antiquities were smuggled and were probably smuggled with real intent to bring them in contrary to federal law. What they have done is they've diversified the collection that's on view. So the material that was in question, this material from the Green family's private collection, is only part of what's on view. They've borrowed a lot of things from the Israeli Antiquities Authority and from other collections, from university collections and private museums, so that not necessarily everything is the Green family collection when you're there.
Though I suppose over time, more of that could be introduced. I mean, nothing's set in stone here.
Absolutely. And that's why the museum bears watching, and bears watching by the scholarly community and by the people who are involved in the watchdog capacity for antiquities. Because the Green family collection is so huge, for 40,000 some pieces, and because all of these groups, the Green family, Hobby Lobby, Museum of the Bible, are basically the same people, we need to make sure that there isn't a sort of shifting around of these objects. And we need to make sure that the Green family's collection is cataloged and the provenance is documented and gets out there so that everything that appears in the museum is clearly provenanced.
We're going to look at that. Philip, we've just got you for half a minute. What does it mean that we have now a major museum in the heart of the capital, on kind of the thick of so many museums there, that you describe as a kind of doing for museums what Fox News did for news? What does that mean about... Is that a slap at factuality? Is it a comment on a super powerful perspective? What does it mean?
I think it means the museum world has finally gotten to the point where we're also sort of dividing into our tribal expectations. And now there's a museum that is likely going to appeal to evangelical Christians and conservative people from the heartland in a way that maybe some of the others felt a little alien to them.
Philip Kennicott, Pulitzer Prize-winning art and architecture critic for The Washington Post. He's been touring the new Museum of the Bible in Washington. Philip, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the new Museum of the Bible in Washington, D.C., and the story behind it of the family that founded Hobby Lobby. Billionaires, their beliefs, looted artifacts, and a move to corral, maybe, American culture toward the Bible. You can join us this hour. Are you headed for the Museum of the Bible? Do you know the story of how it came to be, the story of the Hobby Lobby family, the Greens of Oklahoma City? Do you remember how they fought at the Supreme Court to be exempt on religious grounds from covering contraception? Do you know the story of how the Greens built their huge collection of Bible artifacts? Here's a little bit of a promotional video on the Museum of the Bible's website. A curator talks about its Dead Sea Scroll exhibit. What she doesn't mention is that the consensus among Dead Sea Scroll scholars is that many, if not all, of the 16 fragments there were purchased on the open market are thought to be fake.
Some of the exciting objects that we have that people would recognize are, of course, our Dead Sea Scroll fragments.
Papyrus 39, it's a fragment from the Gospel of John found at the site of Oxyrhynchus. It is from a passage in John 8, and with its 3rd century date, that papyrus is the earliest surviving witness for that passage in John.
I want to dig into the remarkable story of the rather remarkable family behind the Museum of the Bible and Hobby Lobby, the huge art, multi-billion-dollar arts and crafts chain of stores across this country. Joel Baden joins us right now from New Haven, Connecticut. He's a professor at Yale Divinity School. He is co-author of Bible Nation, the United States of Hobby Lobby. It had a recent opinion piece in the New York Times headlined Hobby Lobby's Black Market Buys Did Real Damage. Joel Baden, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Begin to take us in here. Who is the Green family that is so potent in the roots of this museum's creation?
Yeah, so the member of the family who's really behind this museum is Steve Green, who is the chairman of the board of the Museum of the Bible and also the CEO of Hobby Lobby, the crafting store chain that was started by his father, David Green, who is sort of the patriarch of the family and the one who you'll see often on Fox News and giving his sort of political views, and the one who fought the lawsuit famously at the Supreme Court.
David's father, the grandfather Stephen, was a Pentecostal preacher, I think.
Yeah. David's father was a Pentecostal preacher, and all of David's four brothers also went into ministry. And David was the sort of the as self-described black sheep of the family, just didn't feel the call to ministry and ended up, you know, starting a little family business literally in his his family's living room,
a picture
putting together picture frames. And you know, it's a true American success story. He went from that to now $6.5 billion worth in the latest count. It's a magnificent story of real business success. David Green, despite not going into ministry, still sees Hobby Lobby, the crafting store, as a ministry. He uses it, to promote his Christian values. Right, they're not open on Sunday, for example, and also, you know, they tithe 10% of everything they make. They give to charities, and essentially all of the all of the profits they make from the store are funneled back out into various ministries, missions, etc.
So, how did the Green family then behind Hobby Lobby end up as such major collectors of biblical antiquities?
Yeah, it was almost by accident. It wasn't their idea. There was another fellow down in Texas by the name of Johnny Shipman who had this vision to make a Bible museum in Dallas. And he had the vision for what the place would look like, and he didn't have any of the resources to actually make it happen. So he and a partner named Scott Carroll, a fellow who's sort of made a career out of tracking down, hidden biblical artifacts around the world. The two of them went to the Greens and asked if the Greens would be willing to put up some of the money to purchase some of the artifacts that would eventually be in their Bible Museum in Dallas. And after a little bit of time trying to persuade them that this was actually a good idea, the Greens bit, started buying some artifacts here and there. And essentially, as they describe it, they caught the bug and began collecting more and more. And very quickly, being the business people they are, they thought, why don't we just do this whole thing ourselves? And started planning for their own Bible museum that they would then, as it is now, locate in Washington, D.C.
Now, we go from there and we end up over the summer with this, $3 million fine and millions more, a million plus more scraped back by the federal government for illegally importing. What happened there? What was the charge against the Hobby Lobby Greens?
Yeah, so early on when they were collecting artifacts, and this is back in 2010, so just a year after they started, they were offered a rather large collection of cuneiform texts. So these are texts that come out of Iraq, back 3,000 years ago or more. They were offered this rather large collection, 3,000 plus cuneiform artifacts, for which they were to pay $1.6 million, which is not a terrible price considering how many they were getting.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, they went to—
And describe
to,
what those look like, if you would, the cuneiform.
Yeah, these are – I mean, they are small – they're really small clay tablets. They're probably – most of them would be about the size that you could fit in the palm of your hand.
And they look like they've been written in when the clay was still wet, so that—
That's right.
Sort of
so you take a wedge and, mm-hmm. and put the wedge into the clay and you know, mm-hmm. create these signs, these letter forms, and then the clay is hardened and it becomes essentially indestructible. There are thousands of these floating around the world. Most of them, the content is totally banal. They are receipts and you know, they're business transactions and lists and that sort of thing. But they are, you know, they are important texts that come from the time and place adjacent to the Bible, let's say. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so Steve Green and went to Dubai to meet with some Israeli dealers who were offering him these texts, these tablets, and made the purchase. And then when these texts were shipped to America, to Hobby Lobby, they were – the customs forms that should have identified them as cuneiform tablets from Iraq – with a value of thousands of dollars each, they instead arrived in the United States with shipping documents via FedEx, with shipping documents mm-hmm. that said that they were clay tile samples. Remember that these are headed for a crafting store.
Yeah.
Clay tile samples from Turkey that were worth a couple of $100 for the entire package. In other words,
this major archaeological haul completely
right.
misrepresented to customs.
Right, and misrepresented. Precisely in order to get the package underneath the sort of the scrutiny that would come with either a more expensive shipment or one that came out of Iraq. So there's clear intent to get around the customs process. They were caught and a federal investigation began you know, in 2010, 2011. My co-author, Candida Moss, and mm-hmm. I reported the investigation was ongoing. It existed back in 2015 in an article for the Daily Beast. And then, as you said, this past summer, the investigation came to a close. There was the seizure of the artifacts. There was the $3 million and it hit the news.
Now, why was the Iraq origin of these tablets important here? When it comes to questions of antiquities and looting and stolen antiquities mm-hmm. and all the rest, that whole black market. Why was Iraq important?
Yeah. So, you know, almost every country in the world at this point has laws protecting their cultural heritage, you know, laws that say if it's such an old piece, then the government owns, you know, the country owns it unless it is given, you know, an export license. These are especially important, however, in the Middle East and in other areas of the world where there is ongoing war or civil unrest of one sort or another. And obviously that's been the case in the Middle East and in Iraq particularly and especially since the first Gulf War. Essentially what happens is when central governments collapse, you have all sorts of they lose control over over their land and their artifacts, and mm-hmm. people begin digging. In Iraq, you can dig at all sorts of places. There's plenty of places to find them, and be almost guaranteed that you will find something old and valuable to someone. And so, what happens in the wake of these wars, and what's happened over the last 20, 30 years now, is as various groups have taken control, whether it's the Taliban or more recently ISIS, they are using the looting of antiquities as at least one revenue stream, and not the main one, but they will, you know, they will pay a local sort of warlord who will then pay local residents to go dig stuff up.
So, so when the Green family comes in and buys up a ton of this stuff, what's the impact of that?
Yeah. So what we should really be clear about is that and because this is something that you occasionally see out there in the news, the Green family is not supporting ISIS directly, right? They did not buy anything from ISIS. None of their money went to ISIS.
Though we've read when there have been raids on ISIS headquarters, they've had huge stashes of these artifacts.
That's right. What we can say with the Green family, with the Hobby Lobby, is that they purchased their artifacts before ISIS even existed. But what we're seeing, though, is that by purchasing, and this is true of the Greens and it's true of any collector, private or public, who is willing to buy antiquities that do not have proper provenance, right, proper records of where they came from. When people are willing to buy from that market, they are propping up and sustaining a black market. But that is, if Hobby Lobby and people like them were not willing to buy things that were looted, there would be no financial incentive to loot. And there are, you know, they are but one example. There are a ton of people, a ton of private collectors, and has been this way for time immemorial, who are willing to pay to have, you know, cool stuff. You know,
and they've amassed a lot of it. 40,000 artifacts, $205 million collection, we're reading.
I think it's probably actually more than a $205 million collection. That may be what they paid for it, but it's probably not what it's worth at this point. Yeah, and to be fair, right, the 40,000 artifacts is not 40,000 illegally looted artifacts. There's plenty of stuff in there that is, you know, for which the provenance is fine. The problem is, you know, they say we have 40,000 things, and as Philip Kennicott was just mentioning, so we don't know what those 40,000 things are. We can, you know, say they have so many cuneiform texts and they have so many of this and so many of that, but there is no catalog. There's no public record of what they own, and there's no public record of where any of it came from. And, you know, having gotten in trouble once and in a fairly spectacular fashion, one would think that it would behoove them to make their records public so that, you know, we can all be sure that there's nothing else like this going on.
Joel Baden, co-author with Candida Moss of Bible Nation, the United States of Hobby Lobby. Stand by there in New Haven, Connecticut at the Yale Divinity School. Morag Kersell joins me right now in the studio, archaeologist, associate professor of anthropology at DePaul University in Chicago. She researches protecting archaeological landscapes from looting. The director of the Follow the Pots program. Morag, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom. It's great to be here.
What's the overall situation when it comes to antiquities in what we think of as sort of the region of the Bible's origin these days? There's been so much turmoil there, Iraq and beyond. We've seen ISIS blowing things up, selling things off. What's the state of archaeology in this very troubled region?
It's a great question and actually very timely because at the moment, here in Boston, the American Schools of Oriental Research, the American Academy of Religion, and Society of Biblical Literature are having their annual meeting where people are discussing those very issues. So you can go downtown today and hear lectures about these things. But in large part, it is catastrophe for archaeology in the area right now, the unrest, all of the demand, as Joel was just saying, the demand for archaeological material, the undiscriminating demand, let's say. So when collectors don't ask for provenance.
And provenance meaning give us the documentation back to it being unearthed. Who's had control of this? Where'd it come from and who's owned it?
Well, as Joel was mentioning, many of these newly formed countries after World War II they established national ownership laws where the artifacts that are below the ground, yet to be discovered, belong to them. But during times of unrest, you get a lot of upheaval and people looting, and there are markets. And this is part of the problem, that there is a legal market for antiquities in Israel, where tomorrow any one of us could go into a licensed shop, just as the Greens did, buy from a licensed dealer, get an export license, and bring home a piece of the Holy Land.
And the problem with that is, again, does this go back to encouraging the looting of these archaeological sites, or that the provenance, the sort of chain of ownership and understanding of origins is lost in the process? What's the problem?
That's exactly, you've hit the nail on the head. That's exactly the problem, is that we, once in that legal market in Israel, there are illegal artifacts that have recently been looted that are in that market. And because of that, it's entitled, labeled a legal market, but it's actually a gray market in that there are so many illegal elements, we can't really describe it as a legal market. There are looted things entering that market all the time, and registry numbers are being exchanged, and then artifacts that were looted yesterday are legally available for sale as legitimately available.
Joel Baden, what does that say then about this very large collection that the Green family of Hobby Lobby has put together? that much of it was intended for the Museum of the Bible. I don't know how much will actually end up there. These question marks have made the museum, even though Steve Green's very much involved with it, they seem to have shied away from putting some of these things on display, but others could end up on display. Do we know what's real and what's not, Joel?
Well, so there are two issues that you've just raised. One is how much is the Museum of the Bible, this massive new museum, how much is it implicated in the sort of illicit importation practices that Hobby Lobby itself undertook? So on the one hand, the Museum of the Bible folks, and in fact the Hobby Lobby folks also, are adamant that none of what went wrong with Hobby Lobby with this cuneiform thing, none of it has any implication for the Museum of the Bible. And the Museum of the Bible says all of our artifacts on display will have proper provenance, et cetera. They say this over and over again. But it's hard to know at every stage. It's not as if the Museum of the Bible has a catalog of all of its holdings and all of their provenance. They're just like the private collection of Hobby Lobby in that sense. We don't know what they have. We can see what they put on display, but it's not always entirely obvious what they've got in storage and where all of it came from.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the new Museum of the Bible in the nation's capital, Washington, and the story behind it of the family that founded and runs Hobby Lobby. Billionaires looking at their beliefs, looted artifacts, that whole world, and a move to maybe corral American culture toward the Bible. They are ardent evangelicals, no bones about it, and they would like this story to be better known as they present it. Mariah Curcell is with us, archaeologist at the DePaul University in Chicago. Joel Baden is here, professor at Yale's Divinity School and co-author with Candida Moss of Bible Nation, the United States of Hobby Lobby. Mariah, Joel, lots of response online here. I mean, Elizabeth says, look, I have no desire to visit the museum, as long as it does not call itself the National Museum of the Bible and does not receive any tax or other breaks that other private museums get, it has as much right to be in D.C. as any other private museum. And in terms of right, I guess there is no question about that. But other views here as well. Professor Steinberg writes, where is the Museum of the Quran and Torah? Talk about Christian privilege, this listener says. Okay. Then Syed writes, two groups of people stole Iraq's antiquities, ISIS and the Bible Museum. Let that sink in. I don't know if that's too tough a verdict. We'll put it to my guests. And one more here, a listener writes, the Bible Museum is the last thing America needs, a billionaire-sponsored, concrete reification of our most primitive fantasies and delusions, masquerading as a place for learning about reality. Very tough critique right there. Joel, you've a pretty good sense of the Green family. Is this a museum dedicated to reality? Is that the right question when you get into something like the Bible, a holy text, a religious text?
Yeah, so those are some fascinating responses. Mm. So first of all, we can say absolutely they are private individuals who have every right to build whatever museum they want to, wherever they can. There's nothing wrong with that on the face of it. And as to the last comment,
of course, they've chosen to put it in the most kind of public or national, core ground areas.
They're businessmen. Yeah, yeah. They're businessmen, and they know what they're doing. I mean, yeah. Steve Green said to us, look, we chose the Washington, D.C. because if you're going to build a museum, this is where you're going to put a museum. Mm-hmm. But then he went on to say, we're close to the Capitol. We want our legislators to know about the biblical roots of America. Mm-hmm. And that's where, as Philip Kennicott was describing it, right, that's really what the museum is about. So whether that's
reality, establishing that this was a Christian nation, as the Greens would have it.
Yeah, they're not trying to create a Christian nation. They're trying to bring us back to what they consider to be our roots as a Christian, mm-hmm. Bible-oriented, biblical worldview sort of nation. Steve Green said to us at one point, he said, look, there's a real war of ideas going on, a war of worldviews, right? There's the biblical worldview, and then there's communism.
Okay. Here he was in April. This is with the news website Oklahoma Watch, Steve Green. of Hobby Lobby family and chairman of the museum, talking about why he sees the Bible as so important to the United States.
I think that it being foundational to this nation, the more we lose, the less we know of it, the more we're at risk of taking this nation in a different direction than what the founders had originally planned.
And does he want to influence the country toward the Bible by the placement of this museum? Steve Green, very open about that, talking with local radio station Star 102.1. Here he was.
Some people think we're coming here to have an influence on Congress. Of course, the question would be, who doesn't come to D.C. to have an influence on Congress?
Well, and there you are. But then you get into, I'm not sure what reality means, Joel, in this realm. But you're a scholar, and I'll put this to you as well, Morag. I mean, if we get into this gray market where things may be real and may not, it is the reality of these artifacts that is so important to the Green family, right, Joel?
Yeah. So here's where I think their Dead Sea Scrolls are like the perfect, just a prime example of all of these things coming together, right? As we talked about earlier, right? They have purchased a number of Dead Sea Scrolls, mostly in 2009 and 2010, and most scholars think that they are, if not entirely, modern forgeries. They are now on display at the museum. These have no provenance. So here's an example where the museum's statement that we won't put anything on display that doesn't have proper provenance is immediately undermined. The Dead Sea Scrolls have no provenance, the ones that they've purchased. And they have a small placard that says, you know, there's some debate about the authenticity of these and you know, we're doing tests. But this is a place where, you know, the ability to display the Dead Sea Scrolls, as they said in the promo there, right, the oldest mm-hmm. Manuscripts of the Bible, these things have real sort of legitimate power in the eyes of the Greens.
Why is authenticity so important to them? I mean, it may or may not be the case. It may not be the case with these scrolls, but the perception of authenticity is sort of goes to the evangelical perspective on the Bible that they're presenting here.
Yeah, I mean, you've heard, you know, and I think Philip Kennicott said nicely, right, that there is a dual belief in the historical veracity of the Bible, of the story that it tells. It is true, and a belief in the sort of perfect transmission of the Bible from its original writing down to the present, essentially to the King James. And both of those are staunchly held evangelical beliefs. Both of those are very difficult beliefs to maintain in the world of critical biblical scholarship that Morag and I come from. Mm-hmm. And the museum essentially skips discussion of either of those things.
Can I just add something about collectors and the lure of biblical artifacts? Mm-hmm. Because part of my research is interviewing the average person who's buying these things and why they want to own them. Mm-hmm. And in part, it's also about the authenticity is tied up to this may have been held by someone who's mentioned in the Bible. Mm-hmm. There's this tactile response, like nobody wants a replica. Mm-hmm. They want to buy the real thing because mm-hmm. they want to believe that Jesus might have touched it or someone else might have actually come into contact with the artifact they're buying.
Mm-hmm. Of course, when you think of museum, you think not just of zones of faith but zones of fact. Tony in Jamestown, New York. Tony, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Greetings, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I went to Bible college in the same denomination as the Green family. They actually purchased a new campus for my Bible college while I was there.
Where was that, Tony?
It was called Zion Bible College in Barrington, Rhode Island, and they moved to Haverhill, Massachusetts, and they now fancy themselves North Point Bible College.
Okay.
I've since left that faith, and I'm a seminarian with a different faith. Here's my concern. I know that I could walk into that museum, and I could notice the slants and skews that I'm assuming they're giving to history of the Bible, and notice that theological bent, but religious literacy is so bad in our country. Even the average Christian is not going to be able to walk in there and do that. And my concern is that they've walked into the capital of our nation and set themselves up as the national biblical authority And I just don't, I don't have faith they're going to give the biblical history an even-handed treatment, but that they're going to give it their particular theological view, and now they are the national go-to museum of the Bible sitting in our nation's capital.
Tony, let me ask you, because it sounds like you're now a student of theology. You've been in the green world as a student, and now you're outside looking in. You say slants and skews. Like what? What would you look for in the Bible Museum that might reveal those to you as a theologian in training, Tony?
I would be concerned that they would purport the infallible and inerrant Word of God mantra. You know, we were talking about the Dead Sea Scrolls earlier, and this idea that transmission was perfect, that there's never been any question in interpretation, that translation is correct. I mean, come on, we didn't even get the name of Jesus right, and I'm sure your Harvard Divinity School professors there know better than I do. But we didn't even get that right in the long run of history. And yet, their faith purports these are perfect transmissions, perfect documents, infallible and inerrant, theopnostus, spoken by God and preserved through history, which is just, that's number one, not reality.
Tony, what did we get wrong about the name of Jesus? Help me out here.
Oh, it should be Yeshua.
Oh, well, okay.
Joshua in the Hebrew, and we mistransliterated that. Let your Harvard Divinity scholars explain that more than I can.
Tony, you're terrific, and I appreciate your call. I'll come first to you. Tony wonders if what we're seeing here is an effort to portray the history of a religion in a specific way supported by archaeological artifacts as infallible and inerrant because it goes in an unbroken chain back to the very creation of these documents or artifacts. As an archaeologist, looking at the technique of acquisition and portrayal, what do you see?
Well, actually, I wanted to extend Tony's thinking also about the purpose of a museum, because we're talking about the Museum of the Bible, and you know the message that they're giving about religion is one, but also they are a contact zone. So when people go in there, they expect to see real things and get a message or information, or as Philip was talking about, that edutainment that the Museum of the Bible is purported to have. I haven't visited, so I can't comment directly. But so there's a level of expectation, and the museum is not living up to that if they are not presenting all sides to stories, or if they're not they don't have text boxes saying that things are unprovenanced, or that there's disputes over who owns the Dead Sea Scrolls. So I think that they could be failing in that matter as well.
Joel, you've seen a lot of this material. What's the perspective that you see the Green family looking? I mean, they are not shy about this. And I should say, you've written very admiring about this family in many ways. But one of your observations is that they are by no means shy about their perspective on religion, Christianity, the Bible, how they like it to be understood. What do you see?
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, the perspective that Tony was describing in that call is absolutely the perspective of the Green family. I will say,
meaning
the infallibility of the text, the historical accuracy, the perfect transmission. I mean, that is all absolutely part of their belief system. The museum itself does not say any of that outright. It does not say the Bible is infallible. It does not say it was perfectly transmitted. What it does is it communicates those ideas not through positive statements but through omission. That is, there is nothing in the museum to counter that narrative. That is, all of the, you know, reams and reams of biblical scholarship that deal with problems with the historical accuracy of the text, that deal with problems with the transmission history of the text. None of that is present there. And the fact that they have, you know, Dead Sea Scrolls on display, for example, and are displaying them as, you know, how amazing these, you know, these most ancient copies of the biblical text, without, you know, failing to mention that for scholars, what is amazing about the Dead Sea Scrolls is just how very different they are from the Bibles that we know. That fact is simply not going to be present at the museum because it's not part of the worldview that that they come from.
Ben in Norfolk, Virginia. Ben, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you, folks. I really appreciate the chance to hear and listen and be part of your wonderful shows. In short, as an advanced student of yoga, as a father of wonderful children. One is at a Catholic school at St. Patrick's in Norfolk. Wonderful school, by the way. The concern I have, I'll jump to the concern I have regarding this museum, is the promotion of vicarious atonement and the story that the evangelicals and the New Testament have promoted away from what I have studied and what probably some of your Harvard folks and otherwise would say has nothing to do with the truth of the Essene culture, which Jesus, as we know, in part was reared in. And I think this is one of the main problems with our evangelicals in this country is the fact that they think they have the only way to self-knowledge and relationship to the great unknown. And no other faith in the world has ever done it that I know of in this modern society. And I'll leave that ...
Ben, I appreciate your call. I should, Joe, I'll come to you at Yale. I should distinguish there.
What is with this piece? People?
Yeah,
what is it?
What is it?
Come
I don't
on.
Know. I don't know.
It's like Yankees and Red Sox. You can't get that wrong.
Well, but you hear Ben going at. It's something more than church and state here. It's someone who sounds as though he's has an active spiritual and life himself, sends his children to religious school, and he's concerned about the Bible, the Museum of the Bible in the nation's capital,
yeah.
Telling one story here.
Yeah. So I mean, I think that there are legitimate concerns that perhaps are not quite to be expressed that way, right? The museum is not proselytizing. It really isn't. And I think that's true. It's not openly proselytizing at all. But what it does do is have a very constrained notion of what the Bible is, right? The Bible here is essentially the Protestant American form of the Bible. One of the themes, talking about not involving other traditions, one of the things that is a glaring omission at the museum is for a museum about the Bible and its history, you will not find anything about Islam. You will not find anything about Mormonism, which is, I mean, the most American religion that there is. Two major, major religious traditions for whom the Bible is central and scriptural, but they're not in the museum at all because they're not part of sort of the trajectory of the story.
Even though it's part of their faith universe, very, very
– Right. The Bible is absolutely – I mean it's hard to imagine telling the story of the Bible without talking about how the Bible was used in Islam, how the Bible was central to Mormonism.
Yeah.
I mean lots – but it's not in there because for them sort of the Bible stops at the translation into English and the King James.
Morag, we just got half a minute. You're an archaeologist. What would you like to say to the Green family about their ongoing collection, if it is ongoing, how you hope they would pursue it?
Well, I hope that they will really ask questions about the provenance because they had the opportunity to be good collectors and they weren't.
And if they don't at the scale that they collect, what's the consequence?
It's driving the market right now. I mean, it's really changed their
collection. In what direction? Driving it to what?
To buy unprovenienced material. I mean, them doing it is telling a bunch of people, other collectors out there that it's okay and you can do a forfeiture of $3 million and
it may be fake, it may be looted, and on we roll.
Yep.
Things to bear in mind. Praise for the design of this museum, but also some really interesting background story and questions, and I'm grateful to both of my guests today, Morag Kersell from DePaul University. Thank you so much, Morag.
Thanks very much.
And Joel Baden with Candida Moss, co-author of Bible Nation, the United States of Hobby Lobby from Yale Divinity School. Joel, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.